You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. The walls of the house at 20 Johnson Terrace, West Auckland, in County Durham, had seen the recent deaths of four people. It was the house where Mary Ann Cotton sat by her husband Frederick's bedside as his health deteriorated rapidly before his death in September 1871. By March the next year, her stepson Frederick Jr., as well as her own baby Robert, had also perished. She had taken in a lodger, a lover whom she had known for many years, Joe Natris. Before long, Joe became sick too. Mary Ann was a trained nurse and tended to him with the greatest of care and affection. Neighbors came around every day and helped Mary Ann. The poor woman had lost so much already. Dr. Richardson visited every day and diagnosed Joe's condition as typhoid fever. This deadly disease caused the deaths of many people living in the impoverished mining villages of England's Northumberland. Joe knew he was probably going to die. When the doctor asked him if he had taken his medicine to help the symptoms, Joe said that he had not. It was clear that Joe preferred listening to Mary Ann. She was his best friend, after all, and she had tended to so many patients during her lifetime, she knew what she was doing. She made him soup and tea and washed his aching body. A neighbor who was there to help Mary Ann saw that Dr. Richardson was frustrated with his patient. She said, "Dr. Richardson asked Joe if the pain had left him. He said no. Dr. Richardson then said if he could stop purging, he thought he would get better. Joe said, 'This is no fever I have.' The doctor said if he knew better than him, it was no use his coming. Joe was not convinced that he had typhoid fever. He was suffering a great deal, fighting to stay alive. On the 1st of April, 1872, Joe Natris succumbed to his illness. The cause of death on his death certificate said typhoid fever. But Joe himself had said, 'This is no fever I have.' Joe Natris was not the last person to die at 20 Johnson Terrace that year. And soon, people were beginning to wonder if the caring Mary Ann Cotton could perhaps be an angel of death. Mary Ann Robson was born in Low Morsley, England, on the 31st of October 1932 to working-class teen parents Michael and Margaret. Her father was a sinker in a coal mine, a specialized position reserved for skilled tradesmen. Michael and Margaret had another daughter, who died as a baby. Then, when Mary was 3 years old, her brother Robert was born. Mary Ann's family moved around a lot, all around the Durham County area. It was common for miners to be reassigned to another mine when their one-year contract was up. The family relocated with the husband and father and lived in the closest miner's town. Mining companies usually provided a cottage for the family, but that was where the perks ended. Households were poor, and living conditions were rough. In mid-19th century Durham County, most of the men worked in the mines. Most women were wives who kept house and raised children in harsh circumstances. Growing up as a miner's child, a person did not have great prospects to rise above one station in life. Boys grew up to be miners, and girls grew up to be miners' lasses. The Robsons were well regarded in the community. Mary Ann's Sunday school teacher at their Methodist church said that she never missed a lesson, and that she was a girl of innocent disposition and average intelligence, and distinguished for her particularly clean and tidy appearance. In February 1842, Mary Ann's father, 26-year-old Michael, died in a tragic accident at work. While he was repairing a pulley wheel at the Merton Colliery, he fell 150 feet to his death down the mine shaft. Mary Ann, who was only 9 years old at the time, saw how her dad's body was delivered to their home. He was on a wheelbarrow, stuffed into a coal sack with "Property of the South Hetton Coal Company" printed on it. The worker's cottage was provided to the family by Michael's work, so when he passed away, Margaret and her two young children were forced to move out. Marianne was forced to quit school and start working to help support her family. She was good-looking, and as she became a young woman, she caught the attention of the opposite sex. Her mother married George Stott in 1843, who was also a miner. In a time when men needed wives to keep their house and raise their children, women required husbands to provide food and housing. Marriage was a practical arrangement. It was common to remarry soon after one lost a spouse. Marianne did not have a good relationship with her stepfather because he was a strict disciplinarian and staunchly religious. She realized she had to get out and left home at the age of 14 and found a job as a live-in nursemaid. Her boss was Edward Potter, a mine manager, at the mine where her father had worked. Years after Marianne had left the Potter home, her boss Edward still remembered how beautiful he thought she was. Being a nursemaid was a demanding job. The Potters had 12 children, and Marianne did not only have to tend to the kids, but was also expected to cook, clean, and make fires. The days were long, and there was not a lot of freedom. However, working at the Potters' home, referred to as the Hall, was as prestigious as a servant's job could get. Marianne would also have seen how a wealthy household operated, how the other half lived. But she could not stay in this job forever. Once all the Potter children left home for boarding school, Marianne moved back to her mother, brother, and George Stott, and learned the art of dressmaking. She reconciled with George Stott, who probably treated her more like an adult by this time. She referred to him as her father, not stepfather. Marianne taught Sunday school to smaller children and was a devout Christian who trusted in God's will for her life. Marianne remembered her time back home, and although it must have been hard growing up in the impoverished miner's village, she recalled, "I was happy then, and then was days of joy. There was none on earth who was happier than I was then." On the 18th of July, 1852, 19-year-old Marianne married William Mowbray, who was 15 years older than her. Like her father, and most men in town, William worked in the mines. They married at the registrar's office in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. The fact that they did not get married in church suggests that Marianne was pregnant at the time. The newlyweds headed south after the wedding. They found their home in Plymouth. William worked on the railways and Marianne stayed at home. This was a challenging chapter in their lives, a roller coaster of happiness and tragedy. They had 5 children in 5 years, of which 4 passed away. In 1857, broken by the sadness, William and Marianne decided to move back home with their only surviving child, a 1-year-old daughter called Margaret Jane. Back in Durham County, William had no trouble finding a job as the mining industry was booming. For a moment, Marianne's adult life resembled her childhood family. Married women weren't allowed to work. Their job was to focus on the home and children. Some ruled their households with iron fists. But in society, they still had to answer to their husbands. William worked hard and provided for his family, and the hand-to-mouth existence of a miner's wife was harsh for Marianne. Their daughter Isabella was born in 1858, but the family of 4 became a family of 3 again when little Margaret Jane died of scarlet fever. She was only 4 years old. When Marianne, still grieving, gave birth to yet another baby girl the next year, they named her after her sister, Margaret Jane. 2 years later, the Mowbrays had a little boy who they called John Robert William. He only lived for a year. He died after a fatal bout of diarrhea in 1864. In the 7 years since William and Marianne were back home, they had and lost 3 more children. Later, Marianne couldn't remember exactly how many children she had and lost during this time. She was clearly not profoundly connected to them. William got out of the mines and took various jobs, like being a foreman at a factory and later as a fireman on a steam vessel. He was away a lot, leaving Marianne to take care of the home and their 2 remaining daughters by herself. In January 1865, William was booked off work after injuring his foot. Strangely, his condition took a turn for the worse when he developed an inexplicable intestinal disorder. Marianne cared for him as best as she could. After a couple of weeks, William passed away due to typhus fever and diarrhea. In fact, the records state that his attack of diarrhea was so severe, he died within hours of its onset. After 13 years of marriage, Marianne was left to fend for herself and her two girls. Fortunately, William was insured through the British Prudential Insurance Office, and after his death, Marianne received £35. This amounted to half a year's salary in cash. William had also taken out burial insurance for their baby, John Robert, which he never claimed, so Marianne received an additional £2.05. The young widow appeared to be grief-stricken after the loss of her husband. Still, a story was going around town that Dr. Gamage, the physician who tended to William during his illness, had peeped through the widow's window and saw her singing and doing twirls in front of the mirror once he was pronounced dead. Marianne wasn't planning on sticking around to face nasty rumors, so she used the insurance money to set herself up in a new town. With her two remaining children, she moved to the bustling village of Seaham Harbor. Because she was widowed, she was allowed to work, but her dream was to make a living as a dressmaker. Marianne made and sold dresses from home, something she had quite a talent for. She hung the dresses outside her house, and her 7-year-old daughter Isabella was in charge of selling them. It was clear that Marianne had an entrepreneurial spirit, and she wanted to rise out of poverty. However, selling dresses to dirt poor miners' wives was not the ticket. This was terribly frustrating because Marianne always felt she was destined for more extraordinary things in life. She wanted more, and money would give her a better life. In David Wilson's book, Marianne Cotton, Britain's First Female Serial Killer, Richard Lambert is quoted saying that Marianne was a pleasant and interesting woman of considerable energy, intelligence, and ability for her station in life. One newspaper article referred to her as an English Borgia, comparing her to a member of the infamous Spanish noble family. She was tall and slender, with dark hair and gentle eyes. It's quite easy to understand that there was something special about Marianne. While living and working in Seaham, Marianne met and fell in love with a married man called Joseph Natris. As the romance blossomed, tragedy struck again. 3.5-year-old Margaret Jane, the second one, died of typhus fever. Marianne sent her only child, Isabella, to live with her mother and stepfather in nearby New Seaham. In 1865, 33-year-old Marianne Mowbray had lost not only her husband, but also 7 children. She lived alone and supported herself as an independent woman, a widow with no children in her care. She saw Joe in secret, but he soon left, moving away with his wife. Marianne threw all her energy into her new job, working as a nurse at the Sunderland Infirmary, House of Recovery of the Cure of Contagious Fever, Dispensary, and Humane Society. This was in the years of Florence Nightingale's rise to prominence, and nurses had a lot of respect in society. They were seen as the serene guardians of hygiene and health. It was a much coveted job. Exactly what training Marianne received as a nurse is not clear. Sources say she did not do much more than clean the wards, change the bedding, and wash the patients. It was essentially a workhouse where the impoverished elderly would come to live out the rest of their days. There was nothing glamorous about the job, and it hardly paid anything. It was at the infirmary where she met a strong and handsome but illiterate fellow called George Ward. Marianne married him only 7 months after the death of her husband William in the same year. But again, marriage in Victorian England was a matter of practicality, and widowed people remarried as quickly as they could find someone to settle down with. The wedding took place at St. Peter's Church, and there were no friends or family present. George was an engine driver on a steamboat, so like William Mowbray, he wasn't home all that often. But also, because of the illness that landed him in the infirmary where he met Marianne, he couldn't work that often. The couple was married for about a year, and all the while, George struggled with ill health. He was seen by many doctors, and he complained about stomach cramps and a tingling sensation in his hands and feet. 2 doctors visited him at home and kept a close eye on his condition. Because of his health issues, George couldn't work, and the couple had to live on 4 shillings a week welfare money. Sources also speculate that George did not satisfy Marianne in the bedroom. Not surprising, considering he was violently ill, and she was quietly pining for Joe Natris. In October 1866, 15 months after they got married, tragedy struck again. George succumbed to his mysterious intestinal illness. The cause of his death was stated as English cholera and typhoid fever. Again, Marianne had the foresight to take out life insurance enough to help her along. She took a housekeeping job a month after George's death, working for a shipbuilder, James Robinson. James's wife Hannah had passed away and left him with five children, one of which was only a baby. Mary Ann arrived on the 20th of December, and the following day, little baby John was dead. His cause of death was convulsions. James was overcome with grief. He had lost his wife and his son. Mary Ann supported him through this challenging time, and the two became intimate. Mary Ann took charge of the household, and everything ran smoothly for a while. Soon, somewhat scandalously, Mary Ann fell pregnant by James. But as soon as she found out, she had to leave, as her mother was ill and needed her. Margaret Stott was diagnosed with hepatitis and was on the mend, but she needed some help to recover. When Mary Ann was with her mom and stepdad, she took some household items to keep. Margaret realized her daughter was effectively stealing from them and confronted her about it. Within 9 days of Mary Ann's arrival, 54-year-old Margaret, who had almost recovered from hepatitis, passed away. George Stott was not impressed with his stepdaughter's attitude towards her mother in her dying days and wasn't keen on staying in contact with Mary Ann. He was also not up for raising Mary Ann's daughter Isabella Mowbray and told Mary Ann to take her back to James Robinson's home. Whether James was aware of the fact that Mary Ann had a child or not, no one knows. But it is clear that there were tensions in the home. James had three sisters, and they all disliked Mary Ann. Mary Ann did not stand back and took charge of the home, this time not as a servant, but as the lady of the house. The pregnant lady of a busy place with five children, the father of her unborn child who was reluctant to marry her. But the headcount in the Robinson home was soon to be diminished. By the end of April 1867, two of James's children, 8-year-old Elizabeth and 6-year-old James, were dead. Also, Mary Ann's own child, once the apple of her eye, 9-year-old Isabella Mowbray, passed away from gastric fever. The three heart-wrenching funerals were held in the last week of April and the first week of May, one after the other. What James Robinson probably did not know was that Mary Ann was paid £5, 10 shillings, and 6 pence in life insurance money for Isabella. The only children left in the house were young William Robinson and his sister Mary Jane. With Mary Ann obviously pregnant, James Robinson agreed to marry her in the summer of 1867. None of Mary Ann's or Jane's family members attended the wedding. His sisters made no secret of the fact that they did not support their brother's choice. James, on the other hand, conceded to them that he did not have much choice, seeing as though Mary Ann was pregnant by him. He felt it was his duty to take care of her and their child. Their baby daughter, Margaret Isabella, was born in November. Sadly, the infant only lived for 4 months before she also passed away from convulsions. The following year, in 1869, James and Mary Ann had a son called George. James Robinson became agitated when his wife insisted he took out a life insurance policy. Her insistence made him uncomfortable. Besides, he did not believe that life insurance was a wise way of spending one's money. James realized that the numbers in his bank book weren't adding up. He was shocked to discover that Mary Ann had run up debt of more than £60. That was almost double the amount of the insurance money she received after the death of her first husband, William Mowbray. She had made adjustments in their building society book, and James saw right through it, as it wasn't very sophisticated. Mary Ann had also coerced James's son William into pawning household items, and then she kept the money. £50 that James had given Mary Ann to deposit had also gone missing. This was a very significant amount of money at the time. James was furious, and as soon as Mary Ann went away for a couple of days, he boarded up the house and moved in with one of his sisters. He was done with Mary Ann, and she was furious, as she saw James as her ultimate meal ticket, the man who could give her the life she had always wanted. Of all her husbands, James was by far the one with the most money. In a desperate attempt to get him back, Mary Ann left baby George with a friend in December 1869, saying she was going to post a letter. She never returned. George was reunited with his dad, who raised him, along with William and Mary Jane. Some months later, Mary Ann wrote James, asking if he could come and see her and bring the baby. James said no. That was the end of that. A stance that most likely saved not only his life, but also his son's. At the beginning of 1870, Mary Ann was destitute. She had no job and nowhere to live, It's believed that the newly single Marianne spent some time working in a laundry at a home for fallen women in Sunderland, which she was not about to give up. The one and only true friend that Marianne had through the years was an unmarried woman called Margaret. They met while working at the Hall, Edward Potter's home when they were both teenagers. When James Robinson kicked Marianne out, it was Margaret who introduced her to her brother, Frederick Cotton. Frederick worked as a coal miner and had recently lost his wife and two children. Margaret, who had spent most of her adult life as a servant, gladly stepped in to help her brother take care of his children. She confided in Marianne that she had saved an amount of £60. Margaret planned to leave the money to Frederick when she died one day. Margaret invited Marianne to visit her for a couple of days. Margaret was living with Frederick, so Marianne spent a lot of time with the widower. Two is company, three's a crowd. But that was about to change when Margaret fell ill and passed away at the end of March. By April, Marianne was pregnant with Frederick Cotton's child. She left for a while and took a job as a housekeeper for a German doctor. Again, Marianne was taunted about everything she couldn't have. A year before, she was the lady of a house, but there she was, cleaning someone else's home yet again, a fate she could not escape. By the end of summer, she returned to Frederick. With the help of two of his friends, they reconciled and got married on September 17, 1870. Although James Robinson had kicked Marianne out, she was still married to him. But Marianne did not disclose this to Frederick or anyone else, so their marriage was bigamous. Marianne and Frederick's son, Robert Robson Cotton, was born a couple of months after they got married. Marital bliss was short-lived, as Marianne learned that her ex-lover, Joe Natras, was living in West Auckland, only 30 miles away. Since she had last seen Joe, his wife had passed away, so for the first time since they met, he was available, and she wasn't. Marianne had to be near Joe and convince Frederick to move to West Auckland, where they found a place on the very same street where Joe lived. Frederick found a job in the mines, and Marianne was seeing Joe behind his back. But Frederick didn't suspect anything because he was battling a strange illness. In September 1871, after being married to Marianne for just over a year, Frederick Cotton passed away due to typhoid illness. Not long after Frederick's death, his ever-grieving widow, always shrouded in misery, duly collected the life insurance money. Marianne had no husband and was a single mother of three children, Frederick Jr., Charles Edward, and her own baby Robert Robson Cotton. She took in a lodger, well, her lover, Joe Natras, only 3 months after Frederick's death. Marianne found a job of caring for a man called Quick Manning, who was recovering from smallpox. Quick Manning worked as a tax officer at a local brewery and lived down the road from Marianne and Joe. Marianne rather liked Quick Manning, and he reminded her of James Robinson. Well, in the sense that he was of a higher social class than her. He wasn't married, and Marianne sensed an opportunity to escape poverty once and for all and became his lover. Her home life was complicated, living with two stepsons, her baby, and her lover for many years. At the beginning of March 1872, Frederick Cotton Jr. died, followed shortly by the death of baby Robert Robson. Joe Natras pledged his loyalty to Marianne and changed his will in favor of her because, according to her, he had said that she was his best friend. Soon after the paperwork was done, he suffered a bout of gastric fever and grew violently ill. Marianne placed the body of little Robert Robson in Joe's room, waiting for Joe to die so she could bury them at the same time and spare some funeral expenses. It was like a bad omen, reminding him of the fate that awaited him. Joe passed away on the 1st of April, 1872. That is three deaths in Marianne Cotton's home in the space of 1 month. The only healthy living person other than Marianne living in the house was 8-year-old Charles Edward Cotton. Although she was frugal, Mary could somehow always afford another life insurance policy. This time, she insured the life of the last remaining Cotton. Marianne tried to send Charles Edward to an uncle, but the uncle refused. Marianne received welfare money for Charles Edward, but it wasn't only about the money. The boy was in the way. He became more and more of an inconvenience to Marianne, who realized that if she had any chance of becoming Mrs. Quick Manning, bringing her stepson into the picture would ruin everything. Local shopkeeper and administrator of poor relief funds, Thomas Riley, grew concerned about the well-being of Charles Edward. Marianne came to Riley and asked if Charles could be placed in a workhouse. This was a social services home, providing food and shelter to those in need in exchange for labor. Riley said that the workhouse wasn't an orphanage. If Marianne needed help, she needed to move into the workhouse with Charles and work there herself. Marianne did not like the idea and shrugged it off. She said to Riley, "I won't be troubled long. He'll go like all the rest of the Cottons." 5 days later, Marianne had solved the problem. By July 12th, Charles Edward Cotton, like the rest of his family, was dead. When Riley heard about the child's death, he went to the police and insisted they investigated the matter before issuing a death certificate. Marianne was furious when she visited the insurance company and learned that they would not release funds without a death certificate. A coroner's inquest was held. Members of the community gathered in a pub down the road. At the same time, Dr. William Byers Kilburn conducted an autopsy of young Charles on the kitchen table in Marianne's home. The doctor could not find any evidence that Charles had been murdered and had to rule that the boy had died due to natural causes. Marianne kicked up a scene and said Riley made the false accusation against her because she shunned his advances. She insisted that because of the trauma caused to her, she should receive compensation to pay for Charles's burial, which she did. This case caused a sensation in West Auckland, and local newspapers decided to cover the story. Journalists dug up Marianne's past and found that in total, she had lost 3 husbands, 11 children, her mother, and her friend Margaret. Dr. Kilburn was suspicious when he conducted Charles Edward's post-mortem examination. He had an uneasy feeling about the boy's death and kept samples of the boy's stomach contents. He decided to have another look and used the Reinsch test to determine if there was arsenic present. In conducting this test, the doctor took a piece of the stomach tissue and boiled it with hydrochloric acid and water. Then, he inserted a copper coil, and lo and behold, a dark coating gathered on the coil, indicating the presence of arsenic. To confirm his findings, he also sent samples to the leading forensic scientist at the time, Dr. Thomas Scattergood in Leeds. He came to the same conclusion. Charles Edward's body was exhumed, and Marianne was charged with his murder. She was arrested at her home a week after the boy's death on the 18th of July, 1872. Marianne shocked police by telling them that she was pregnant with Quick Manning's baby. Because of this, the trial was put on hold until she had given birth. Quick Manning did not want anything to do with Marianne or the baby that she claimed was his. A further order was issued by police to exhume the bodies of Joe Natras, her stepson Frederick Cotton Jr., and her own baby Robert Robson Cotton. Crowds gathered to witness the macabre operation of digging up the recently deceased bodies. Again, samples were sent to Dr. Scattergood, who found that they had all been poisoned. In fact, Joe had 4 times the lethal amount of arsenic in his body. In Victorian times, arsenic was readily available in stores. It was as easy to purchase as bleach or laundry soap. It was odorless, colorless, and would only show up after a death. Symptoms of arsenic poisoning compare with symptoms of typhoid, typhus, and gastric fever, headaches, fever, general pain, and cramping. In the case of typhoid, symptoms include either constipation or diarrhea. Also, diagnoses of the time weren't always spot on. Victorian doctors used the terms typhoid and typhus interchangeably when in actual fact, they are quite different. Typhoid fever occurred in places with poor sanitation and caused by salmonella bacteria found in contaminated water or milk. Typhus fever, on the other hand, was due to overcrowding. Its main characteristic was a rash caused by lice. Typhoid fever was prevalent along the East Coast Northumberland at the time. Besides mining accidents and consumption, it was one of the leading causes of death. A neighbor, Marianne Dodds, told police that Marianne Cotton had sent young Charles Edward to the chemist to buy arsenic and soft soap because she wanted to clean a bug-infested mattress. The chemist refused to sell arsenic to the boy as it was illegal. Eventually, Marianne convinced her neighbor, the other Marianne, to buy it on her behalf. The two women made up the mixture and cleaned the mattress together. However, they did not use all the arsenic, and Marianne Dodds remembered Cotton putting it in a jar in a storeroom. This proved to police that Marianne Cotton had the poison in her home, and they were convinced that she knew how to use it to end her victims' lives. She served them soup and tea, as arsenic dissolves in warm liquid, and the taste of the tea or soup would have masked the flavor. On the 10th of January, 1873, baby Margaret Edith Quick Manning Cotton was born in Durham County Jail. Mary Ann gave her daughter to her former neighbors, William and Sarah Edwards, for adoption. Lloyd's Weekly newspaper reported that the parting of the wretched mother with the child was a very affecting one. In the end, only two of Mary Ann's children survived, Margaret Edith and George Robinson. From the moment Thomas Riley first accused Mary Ann Cotton of murdering her stepson, she maintained her innocence. While in prison, she wrote letters to neighbors and childhood friends, even to her ex, James Robinson, asking for their support. Many of her letters were published in newspapers, and some people began to feel sympathy for her plight. The trial of Mary Ann Cotton began on the 5th of March, 1873. She maintained her innocence, but on the advice of her solicitor, did not speak in her own defense. The trial was a spectacle, and was well covered in newspapers of the time. There was not an empty seat in the courtroom, the crowd mainly consisting of women. If people could not find seats inside, they waited outside, hoping to catch a glimpse of the woman who had done the unthinkable. Mary Ann was demure, pale, not quite the siren she had been made out to be in earlier days. While sitting in the accused dock, she breastfed her baby. Many people believed this was an attempt to gain sympathy from the jury. Her defense tried to create reasonable doubt in blaming the chemist for selling Mary Ann the arsenic instead of bismuth powder, commonly used for diarrhea. When that didn't seem to cause enough doubt, he claimed that the arsenic present in Charles's body came from inhalation of wallpaper containing arsenic. Mary Ann herself was convinced the arsenic was mixed with arrowroot and said that Charles Edward ingested it without knowing what he was eating. The renowned forensic toxicologist Dr. Scattergood was called to the stand, and his remarks squashed the wallpaper theory. He claimed that inhalation would have caused suffocation, which was not how Charles had died. He also said that the most likely way the arsenic was given to Charles was in powder form, like when it was mixed with soft soap. At the end of the week, Mary Ann was convicted of the murder of her stepson, Frederick's child, Charles Edward Cotton. The jury deliberated for only 1.5 hours, and she was sentenced to death by hanging. The Times reported on the verdict saying, "After conviction, the wretched woman exhibited strong emotion, but this gave place in a few hours to her habitual, cold, reserved demeanor. And while she harbors a strong conviction that the royal clemency will be extended towards her, she staunchly asserts her innocence of the crime that she has been convicted of." Petitions were sent to the Home Secretary by friends and neighbors. Mary Ann's last lodger, William Lowry, wrote to local newspapers to garner up support for Mary Ann. He also kept in regular contact with her while she was in prison and told her that her lawyer sold her belongings to cover legal fees. The petitions written by Lowry and others didn't help. Mary Ann's fate was sealed. Mary Ann Cotton had been called Britain's first female serial killer, which brings about the question of nature or nurture. Perhaps it was a bit of both. Who knows what effect of seeing her father's body delivered to their home in a bag had on the young Mary Ann. In most cases, she didn't seem to kill for the sake of killing. Her reasons were driven by practicality. Whenever things weren't working out the way she wanted them to, she would clear the decks and start from scratch. As was the case of baby John Robinson. It didn't take Mary Ann long to see the challenges of her new job. A motherless infant would have made caring for the other four children in the household a highly demanding task. Also, by acting soon after she arrived, there was no suspicion of her. She probably administered arsenic without anyone noticing, tending to a crying baby when she knew all too well how it all would end. Typically, a poisoner chooses his method of murder because there was no blood or physical violence. The killer can remain detached, while reveling in the power of playing God, deciding who lives and who dies. In reality, the arsenic poisonings committed by Mary Ann would have been messy. Most of her victims vomited and had severe diarrhea with poor in-house sanitation. The filth and stench of her dying victims must have been horrendous. And she was the one who cleaned it all up, who tended to them. Her time as a nurse probably helped her cope with it. A neighbor who later testified against Mary Ann described Joe's agony. This quote from her statement has been tweaked from the original Victorian Northumberland English used. Mary Ann waited on him and was constantly with him. I saw no one else wait on him. Mary Ann gave him anything he required. Joe Natris was sick several times and purged. Occasionally, he complained of pain at the bottom of his bowels. I saw him have fits. He was very twisted up and seemed in agony. He twisted his toes and his hands and contorted them always. He pulled his legs up. He was throwing himself around a good deal, and Marianne held him and had to use great force. He was unconscious when having these fits. After the fits were over, he sometimes said it was a very strong one, and sometimes said it was not. She also committed her murders in full view. She was the caring mother and wife who lovingly nursed her loved ones throughout their suffering. Marianne called doctors herself and was convincing in her feigned concern about the health of her family. She made endless cups of tea, laced with arsenic, of course, to make it look like she was caring for them. It is one of the cruelest ways imaginable to kill someone. It's prolonged, and the victims suffer a great deal. One can wonder why she always kept one or two children alive. Perhaps because they were useful to her. Maybe it was to cast suspicion away from her, that she was a mass murderer who killed the whole family, when in fact she did it bit by bit, one after the other. That in itself is a form of torture. They've lost their siblings and a parent. Even at a time in history when the mortality rate was high, this must have been terribly traumatic. Witnessing the violent suffering and being unable to help, it must have been torture in itself. William Robinson saw his whole family wiped out before suffering the same fate. As did Isabella Mowbray. They were 8 and 9 years old, about the age Marianne was when she had lost her own father. They were left to deal with the grief and loneliness, just to eventually get killed as well. Marianne's deeds went undetected for a long time. In the mid-19th century, the infant mortality rate in Durham County was 180 per 1,000 life births. In England today, it's 4 per 1,000. The fact that she moved around and that the insurance company did not have centralized data system kept her under the radar for decades. She had many incarnations, and when she was done, she would kill everyone around her to get into a new situation. Somewhere in the heartless story of a cold-blooded murderess lies a twisted love story, too. Why, one can wonder, did Marianne kill the love of her life, Joe Natras? Joe does seem to be the only man, probably besides her first husband, William, who Marianne actually cared for. She had waited for so many years to be with him. But the reality of daily domestic life, living with her dead husband's children, was perhaps not quite as romantic as she had hoped it would be. She also realized that with Joe, she would never rise above her station, as he was just a minor. Quick Manning was her ticket out of poverty, but Joe was a complication. When he told the doctor, "This is no fever I have," did he know? Marianne Cotton was spared a public execution, and on the 24th of March 1873, 20 reporters gathered at the gallows in Durham County Jail. Her executioner was William Ong Calcraft, who had quite a reputation of finding pleasure in his job and made sure the condemned suffered before he launched them into eternity. He had many fumbled executions behind his name and was known to drink heavily. On the day of Marianne's execution, a crowd of hundreds gathered outside of the prison walls, waiting for 8 a.m. Reports said that after finishing her last refreshment, a cup of tea, she brushed her long black hair and said she was ready. As she walked to the gallows, she held her head high and took her place on the trap doors, pale and trembling. She muttered continuously, but no one could hear what she was saying. The only sentence they could make out was, "Heaven is my home. Lord, have mercy on me." Calcraft had shortened the rope, and instead of breaking her neck, making death instant, Marianne was strangled to death. It took 3 agonizing minutes of Mary kicking and gasping, desperately trying to breathe. Calcraft stepped closer and pushed her down to make sure she lost consciousness. Witnesses were horrified at the brutality of the botched execution. In fact, Calcraft himself announced his retirement at breakfast on the same morning after Marianne's execution. She was buried in the prison cemetery at Durham County Jail, with her shoes still on. After her death, she became an almost mythical creature, someone who had existed in folklore. The Newcastle Chronicle described her as a monster in human form. A skipping rhyme made its rounds, and little children sang the haunting words, Marianne Cotton, she's dead and she's rotten, lying in bed with her eyes wide open. Sing, sing, oh what should I sing? Marianne Cotton, she's tied up with string. Where, up in the air, selling black puddings a penny a pair. Marianne Cotton, she's dead and forgotten, lying in bed with her bones all rotten. Sing, sing, what can I sing? Marianne Cotton, tied up with string. Marianne was only ever convicted for the murder of Charles Edward Cotton, none of her other victims. There are no birth records of the baby she had and lost in Plymouth. It is possible she suffered miscarriages or that the babies were stillborn. Because there is no record of their existence, it is unclear if she actually killed any of them. There was also the possibility that she had many more victims whose causes of death were incorrectly documented. It seemed like whomever dared fall in love with Marianne had stepped into the spider's web, and the Black Widow was always ready to strike. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.